I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. It's January 21st, 2025. Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 47th President of the United States amidst trepidation in the Washington, D.C. region and in its federal workforce. For Maryland and many states around the country, it's budget time. We have details of Maryland Governor Wes Moore's budget plan. $1.4 billion in net cuts, $1.3 billion in new taxes and fees, and close to $800 million in transfers from savings. But you will want to know the breakdowns. Maryland House of Delegates Economic Matters Committee held a hearing last week on rising electricity prices, which we have been following for some time, and we have some takeaways. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by the Political Science Program at UMBC Shady Grove, where you'll learn a strong foundation in public policy, pre-law, and international affairs for an impactful career in a number of essential areas. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the 1920s. Song recordings and films from a century ago just entered the public domain this January. First up, Tea for Two by the Benson Orchestra of Chicago. Donald Trump was sworn in as the 47th President of the United States yesterday. With his former rivals and the country's billionaires extending to him legitimacy, even as they wait for what this peaceful transfer of power will bring. The political establishment has long understood the difference between campaigning and governance. But Trump, a self-described political neophyte, has not wanted to be constrained by the expectations and realities of governing the country as a whole. Most visibly, Nancy Pelosi, Michelle Obama, and Karen Pence stayed away from the inauguration. Trump has long had problems with women in his personal life and his public life. And here we are with women at the core of the resistance against him once more. Democrats generally have been between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they have wanted to demonstrate that they are not sore losers and respect the long American tradition of peaceful transfer of power, especially since their criticism of Trump centered on the January 6th insurrection and Trump's refusal to participate in the formal transfer of power process in 2021. But on the other hand, if Trump really represents a fascist turn in America, a peaceful transfer of power just legitimized fascism. It's a tough place to be in, and the past presidents gathered at the inauguration yesterday surely felt the weight of that responsibility. The cold weather had led Trump to move the oath-taking ceremony from outside the Capitol to inside the building in the very rotunda, which was breached in 2021 by the insurrectionists acting in his name and backing his continued presidency even after he had lost the election. The high ceiling, the ornate paintings, and the white marble yesterday seemed like stage cutouts rather than the home of democracy. Before we go any further, here is a letter we received from a listener.
Hi, Sunil. This is Aaron Droller from Silver Spring. I wanted to make a comment on your latest I Hate the Politics podcast from January 14th, in which you repeatedly cite to a poll as evidence of the public's support for the Attainable Housing Strategies Initiative, or AHSI. I think there's some context that you should have provided your listeners when you refer to this poll. This poll was commissioned by Greater Washington, which is an advocacy organization that has been vocally and aggressively in favor of AHSI. I think this is important context for listeners to judge the validity of this poll and should have been noted. Even if one takes the validity of the poll at face value, respondents decisively came out against reducing parking in that same poll. This is important context because the reduction of parking minimums is one of the central pillars, if not the central pillar, on which AHSI depends. Can't have AHSI without reducing parking minimums. So I think that's important context that you should have added when referring to this poll. Thanks for everything you do to keep the community informed.
We love to hear from you when you like the show and when we have been remiss. If you think we got something wrong, send us a voice letter. It's easy. Record on your phone and email the file to producer@ihppod.org. Make sure to include your full name and where you live. Last week, when Maryland Governor Wes Moore presented his 2025 budget proposal, he said he was responding to two storms.
We are releasing our proposal to balance the state budget. And we know that we're releasing this proposal while there are two storms that are swirling around our state, and our budget responds to both. The first storm is a fiscal crisis nearly a decade in the making. Where what we saw is under the former administration, state spending in the general fund budget increased by 70% in the 7 years before I took office. While the budget increased by 70% in those 7 years, we also saw economic growth stall. Where during that time period, we saw the nation's economy continue to grow while Maryland's economy continued to stay flat. So while we were spending, we were not growing. Emergency COVID money from the federal government papered over a structural deficit that had been warned by experts since 2017. And now, we face the worst fiscal crisis in at least 20 years, one even worse than the Great Recession. The second storm is a stark new policy direction from the Trump-Vance administration that threatens to disrupt Maryland's economy. So in partnership with the General Assembly, it is our responsibility to help the state weather these two storms and emerge stronger.
Yesterday, the state's Department of Legislative Services put numbers on both the storms. Here is Teresa Tuzinski talking about Maryland's federal exposure.
There are about 160,000 civilian federal jobs located in the state of Maryland. About 12,000 of those are in the Postal Service. That number does not include civilian workers at the National Security Agency. It is a classified agency, and so their employment count is also classified. Even outside of the National Security Agency, a lot of those jobs are in the national security area, but we have about 45,000 civilian jobs in the Department of Defense in Maryland and the various service branches, the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force. Other major agencies are Health and Human Services, where there's about 40,000 jobs in Maryland. The bulk of those are at NIH and the Food and Drug Administration. There's also about 13,000 jobs in the Department of Commerce in Maryland. But it's not just about the direct jobs located in the state. Of course, a lot of Marylanders commute to federal jobs in the district and in Virginia, and each of those jurisdictions have about 190,000 federal civilian jobs. To get a picture of the overall impact of federal employment on Maryland, the Comptroller's Office looked at tax year 2021 data and identified every taxpayer who had a W-2 from the federal government, meaning that they had gotten wage income from the federal government in tax year 2021. That worked out to be about 8% of all Maryland taxpayers. They had, in total, about $24 billion of federal wages, and that accounted for about 12% of total wages reported in federal adjusted gross income for Maryland residents in 2021. If you do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation applying an effective tax rate, that $24 billion of wages supports about $1 billion, roughly, of Maryland personal income, state personal income, and about $700 million of local income tax. It's not just about direct federal employees. Of course, the federal spending has a big effect on the Maryland economy through the private sector. There's a lot of federal contract spending. In federal fiscal year 2023, federal contract spending for work performed in Maryland was about $42 billion, and that equates to about 10% of private sector gross state product. The state budget itself is dependent on federal dollars. There's about $20 billion of federal funds in the fiscal 2026 allowance.
I'll get back to the budget in just a minute. But one thing to consider is that blue states like Maryland are bracing for Trump to take action beyond workforce issues. The thinking appears to be that policy areas governed by statute, like criminal justice, will be less affected than policies governed by regulations, where federal agencies have to rethink their approach following the 2024 Supreme Court decision in Loper Bright, which ended the Chevron deference. The latitude federal judges extended to federal agencies in the interpretation of statute. Blue states are also apprehensive about harsh immigration action by the new administration against residents, even though immigration policy is a mix of statute and regulation. Several local and state immigrant support nonprofits, such as CASA, have made concerted public outreach to get information out on what to do in case of an immigration raid. Actual government resistance may be tricky, as federal law preempts state and local law. Reflecting the larger conundrum, Governor Moore, in an interview with the Baltimore Banner, said, "I am not the leader of the resistance. I am the governor of Maryland." The second issue of concern in Maryland is environmental protection. Maryland has a set of ambitious net zero goals, which could be vulnerable to federal action via the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or a weakened environmental protection agency. Of particular concern is continued EPA support for Chesapeake Bay restoration. The Chesapeake Bay Watershed Agreement is a EPA-brokered and monitored partnership between the seven watershed states to clean up the largest estuary in the United States. The agreement is up for renewal in 2025. All the states except Virginia are run by Democrats, but without federal support, progress could slow down. All of this makes Governor Moore's argument for economic development in the state all the more urgent.
First things first, we've got to grow our economy. From 2017 to 2022, the national economy grew by 11%. Maryland's economy grew by just 3%. Maryland is the home of things like the NSA and US Cyber Command and NIST and APL. And the future home of the FBI. Like, Maryland has all these assets here. But if you look at our balance sheet, I couldn't tell you that there are priorities. I couldn't tell you there's an investment strategy around that. Massachusetts, decades ago, decided, they said, you know what? We're the home of Harvard. We're the home of MIT. Why are we not investing in biotech? And they made a strategic investment. And guess what Massachusetts is right now? The national leader in biotech. Kentucky said, listen, we think that the ball is moving towards EV battery technology. We want to be able to be a leader in EV battery technology. So Kentucky started investing in EV battery technology. They made a choice. The problem with Maryland is that we have not made a choice. We've oftentimes leveraged our investments on things like the things that have been the historical legacy industries within the state of Maryland, the EDs, the Feds, and the Meds, all things that are important and all things that we have to protect as an economy. But at the same time, if we are not leveraging life sciences in Maryland, if we're not leveraging IT in Maryland, aerospace and defense tech, then what are we doing? Economic growth is our North Star. We are channeling $750 million towards economic growth this year. We will invest in growth. I propose $128 million in new targeted and strategic investments towards specific areas that will strengthen our competitiveness. Areas like quantum and cyber and life sciences and aerospace and defense tech. Because Maryland has some of the greatest assets that you could want in the entire country here that are tethered to the state of Maryland. So why our balance sheet does not reflect an investment in those areas, I have no idea, and that changes.
The governor is also required to balance the budget and has proposed new taxes and spending cuts, both of which are likely to cause heated debate in the legislature. On the revenue side, the governor's budget proposal creates two new tax brackets for the highest income earners in the state. The tax rates in the higher brackets also increase, and there will be a 1% surcharge on capital gains above $350,000. The proposal has further simplified tax calculation by getting rid of itemized deductions, and it keeps and increases the standard deduction. These income tax-related changes are expected to produce almost $900 million. On corporate taxes, the state is finally getting combined reporting, which prevents companies from transferring profits from one state to another in order to reduce tax burdens. In return, they will get a slightly lower tax rate. Separately, Governor Moore has proposed a retail delivery fee of 75 cents on each purchase that is expected to produce $225 million, which will go to the Transportation Trust Fund, not the General Fund. The governor framed the changes in this way.
This year, we have put forward a common sense package for tax reform that will make taxes simpler, fair, and pro-growth. And for the third year in a row, we will not raise sales taxes. For the third year in a row, we will not raise property taxes. That we are closing corporate loopholes and help lower the overall corporate tax rate to make Maryland more attractive, to make Maryland more business friendly, and to stop losing competition with our neighbors. And with this budget, nearly two-thirds of Marylanders will receive a tax cut. And in fact, 82% of Marylanders will either receive a tax cut or see no change to their tax status at all. I'll repeat that again. Two-thirds of Marylanders are going to get a tax cut. 82% of Marylanders will either get a tax cut or see no change to their tax status at all. And Marylanders who have done exceptionally well financially, we're going to be asked to contribute a little bit more.
On spending cuts, the governor said,
we will propose in this budget $2 billion in total cuts this year. And we have taken a narrow and a targeted approach that focuses on boosting efficiency and delivering results.
The spending cut proposals take several pages in the DLS fiscal report. The big items include changes to the blueprint law requirements, which permanently reduces the required behavioral health support from $130 million to $40 million. Delays by 4 years funding for the initiative to increase teacher planning time, saving $124 million this year and $500 million by 2029. delays planned expansion of aid for high-poverty schools by 2 years, caps a scholarship for early childhood or pre-K placements of students from low-income families. The changes to the blueprint law reduce and push back the ballooning growth in blueprint expenses to the out years. On Health and Human Services, the Developmental Disabilities Administration loses $97 million this year and $235 million next year. Together with the removal of itemized deductions, which benefited families of disabled people, and the loss of $25 million in support for non-public placement of special education students, disability spending cuts is looking like it could become the hot issue this legislative session. The other hot issue is the plan to shift $144 million in costs from state to local governments. Here is Michael Sanderson, the executive director of the Maryland Association of Counties.
The biggest piece in this puzzle is that the state is going to shift some costs onto county governments for the pensions of public school teachers. So for years and years, the pensions were paid for by the state, even though the school systems would pay the wages and so forth for employees in the school system. And there's a reason for that. The state runs the pension system. So all of like the benefits and when you can retire and what your multipliers are and when you can vest and all that stuff is set as policy at the state level. Counties and school boards don't set any of that sort of stuff. It was a little more than a decade ago that the state teacher pension system was getting super expensive and the state had a fiscal crunch. They shifted some of those costs onto the local school systems. This year's budget reconciliation bill it's about $92 million bucks, basically coming off the books from the state pension system. It's going to be basically an invoice to the county governments for our share. That's a pretty big policy shift. It'll be frustrating for counties. A couple other things that are sort of interesting on the policy level. One is for actually related to the shift of pension costs some years ago, the state did a number of offsets saying, okay, we don't want this burden to be overwhelming, especially for some of our lowest wealth jurisdictions. So they created a special grant to help with the teacher retirement costs. And that grant's being phased out. It's 8 or 9 counties. It's a total of about $30 million. The way the reconciliation bill is, it'll be funded in half for 26 and then 0 from 27 and thereafter. That's a meaningful chunk of money, especially to a couple jurisdictions. Prince George's and Baltimore City are both large jurisdictions with lower than the state average in their overall income base and wealth base. And one more thing that is kind of tricky policy stuff is the state runs the assessment office. The people who go and look at property and make an evaluation of property for tax purposes, that's a state function in Maryland. Lots of places let the local governments do that, and they hire the people, and you might even elect your assessor or auditor or the person who's in charge of that process. And here, it's a centralized state function. We've always said that's a really good idea to have it not in the hands of the governments who depend on the revenues. The proposal here is to bill the counties, basically just invoice the counties for 90% of those functions. So increasing that number from the current 50 to 90% basically makes us fully responsible for the funding. But you know, in practice, again, we don't manage that function. We don't make any decisions about it. We're just getting the invoice.
Do you have a dollar value for that?
I think it's going to be around 20 or thereabouts. When you get substantially north of $100 million, what you're talking about are county budgets that already, I mean, for the most part right now, new revenue coming into county governments is just being absorbed by education. The state has embarked on this quest to try and get back to number one in public education. They've got their formulas, but they're also asking the counties to do an awful lot and do our share. And county budgets right now are just engines for education in large part. These are resources that kind of have already been spoken for. It's just going to be a twist on the county budget.
Michael Sanderson, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lastly, in reporting expected cuts in previous weeks, that the university system of Maryland would be cut by about 5% or $350 million. Turns out it is much lower at $106 million. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that come out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from the newly in public domain tunes from the 1920s. We heard the Paul Whiteman Band, their work, I Will See You in My Dreams, and Carl Fenton's Limehouse Blues. Those were within the episode. And now we go out with Jan Garber with the number I Want to Be Happy. Who can argue with that? Usually we feature local music on the show. If you want to share your music on the podcast or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. See you next time.